You love your father?
Yes, sir.
Listen to your parents and teachers. They got a line on most things, so don't treat them like enemies. There's always an outside chance you can learn something.
What difference do you think you can make one single man in all this madness? If you die, it's going to be for nothing.
Try to keep an open mind. Try to understand the viewpoints of others. Consider the minority opinion, but try to get along with the majority of opinion once it's accepted. 特区宽泛
From Tuscaloosa, Alabama, I am Corey Kraft. This is Aspect Radio.
And I am Ben Flanagan. Welcome to another episode of the show. And it might be only God who forgives, but I have a feeling that I'm not going to forgive Corey for how he feels about the new Nicholas Winding Refn film, Only God Forgives, which is now available on demand. But speaking of forgiving and whatnot, it seems unforgivable that there would be a Japanese remake of the movie Unforgiven that will be out later this year. It stars Ken Watanabe in the Clint Eastwood role, and this is a film that won the 1992 Best Picture Award along with Best Director and a couple of other Oscars. And honestly, until today, I had no idea that there would be a remake. I hadn't heard it in any of the trades or on Twitter or anything, and then the trailer just popped up and I watched it. And I have to say, it looks like a pretty slick rendition of the movie, and it definitely piqued my interest. But I have the age-old question just sort of like whirring around in my stomach right now. Is this right? Does it feel like the right thing another studio or filmmaker should be doing after just 21 years ago, we had this great film that Clint Eastwood made that nobody saw coming and won Best Picture and people embraced, and another Western that somehow people embraced. And yet here we are remaking it when we're remaking so many other things, films that should be remade, films that definitely should not. Corey, which category would you put this remake of Unforgiven in? The films that should not be remade or should be remade?
Well, first of all, I want to compliment you on your wordplay to open off the show.
Thanks,
that
Corey.
Was impressive. But I'm, as I usually am, a split mind about this. It's not as if Hollywood does not have a super long history of borrowing and unofficially remaking samurai films. When you look at all of the films that Akira Kurosawa inspired with his catalog over the decades, things like the Man with No Name trilogy starring Eastwood, or even Star Wars, from which George Lucas drew inspiration from The Hidden Fortress. So you have an interestingly storied history of that. It has resulted in a lot of films that people love but have overshadowed, I guess, the original Japanese samurai version in some ways. Well, I find it interesting at the very least that now we have a samurai film borrowing from an American Western. It seems appropriate in some way that you'd have a film like this based on, albeit a modern classic Western, sort of a reversal, I guess, of that typical trend. And I'm not necessarily opposed to remakes, even of classic movies, if they put a cultural spin on the material like this seems to. Transplanting that story into a samurai setting seems like a pretty good idea to me. I mean, it's one of those stories that would play pretty well, I think, in that context. I would be extremely opposed to another American filmmaker trying to remake Unforgiven as an American Western, because clearly the story has been told in that format extremely well. But with a new take and a fresh take and sort of a new context, I'm not necessarily opposed to it.
If I had seen this on paper first, I would have been extremely opposed to it. But the fact that someone just threw the trailer right in front of my face and I clicked play, I had a different reaction to it. I actually think it looks good. I think Ken Watanabe is excellent casting in the role of, I guess, he won't be called William Money in this movie, but he looks like he's doing good work there. And like you said, this in a completely different setting and in a totally different culture seems like an interesting story to tell. Of course, again, if I had known on paper, I would have thought, the first thing I probably would have thought of was that Blood Simple remake that was made overseas a few years ago, which turned out to be
Zhang Yimou.
A disaster for some people.
Yeah, a woman, a gun, and a noodle shop. It
exactly.
was really bad.
Yeah, but I mean, that's an isolated incident, I guess we could say.
Yeah.
And the United States has certainly done its fair share of plucking these great movies out from other cultures. Like we had mentioned before, the films that were inspired inspired by Kurosawa. A good example is probably 2006's The Departed, which a lot of people embraced. So look, it can work out, but I'm of the mind that remakes aren't a good idea if that's your first idea. I like original stories and original movies, but if you think that you can tell this story in a different and unique way, do it, I guess. If it turns out to be good, then it's good. You can't argue with a good movie. Oftentimes, it's me arguing just based on sheer principle where I didn't want it made in the first place, but there are remakes that I've liked in my life. It's just when you say, I'm going to remake Unforgiven, the question is, why remake Unforgiven? What's the point? Unforgiven exists and it's great. Make your own movie. Clint Eastwood did it. But anyway. Michael Bay's reboot of Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles will be coming out a few weeks later than planned. Instead of June 6th, 2014, it'll be released August 8th, 2014, 1 week after Guardians of the Galaxy from Marvel and 1 week before The Expendables 3. And the film stars Megan Fox, Will Arnett, Whoopi Goldberg, and William Fichtner in human roles, and they're going to be some CG turtles running around saying probably stupid things. So this isn't necessarily valuable news to me, but it just makes me want to throw my hands up in the air and ask what the hell is going on in Hollywood sometimes.
This is just par for the course. At this point, after this summer, just sort of kicked me while I was down over and over again with the movies that Hollywood put out. Sure, whatever. Shovel it on. Shovel on your Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles nonsense with Megan Fox, I guess, is April. Is she playing April?
I would assume so.
I would assume so, too.
Whoopi Goldberg?
Whatever.
What's going on?
Who knows?
I mean, Will Arnett, great in certain things, but, I mean, can you imagine?
Yeah, he's playing Shredder or something.
Oh, man. I mean, after what he has done with this Transformer franchise, some of which I know for a fact that you have said you've liked on the record, I don't know how you feel about it now, but the fact that he's going after another one of our beloved toy lines, let's be honest here, but toy lines...
I don't know if I would say beloved either.
Well, toy lines that were able to generate decent cartoons and video games and eventually feature films. I'm a fan of the first two live-action Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtle movies. I like them. You know,
Turtles in Time, man.
That's part three. I wasn't crazy about that one. I'm more Turtles Secret of the Ooze.
Whatever.
That's more, I'm a big Kino fan.
I don't know. I haven't seen any of those movies since I was like six. So
that's probably why I like them so much, is because I'm clinging to these memories of these films. But yeah, just raised my eyebrows to see who was in this movie. I didn't know who had been cast in it, and it's just all coming together in Michael Bay's psychotic fantasy world that only he seems to understand and be living in.
Meanwhile, we have Transformers 4 next summer, too, so you have that to look forward to.
Well, this is going to be opening a week before Expendables 3, and speaking of Expendables 3, there was some recent casting news, at least since our last show, when we talked about Pacific Rim. As of now, here's who the cast includes. Sylvester Stallone, Arnold Schwarzenegger, Harrison Ford, who will be taking the place of Bruce Willis, Wesley Snipes, Jason Statham, Antonio Banderas, Mel Gibson recently confirmed, and coming back are Jet Li, Dolph Lundgren, Terry Crews, and possibly rumored to be circling the project, Nicolas Cage, Jackie Chan, Steven Seagal, and Mickey Rourke reprising his role since the first movie. That's just a ridiculous cast, and they've all been ridiculous casts up to this point, but they seem to be getting bigger and bigger and bigger, and while I'm not necessarily expecting all of these people to be in one place at one time, I suspect that they're going to be employing plenty of green screen technology to make this movie. Seeing all those names at least gets me a little bit excited, even though you and I haven't been big fans of this franchise up to this point. Maybe the films won't look so cheap this time now that they've got the likes of Harrison Ford and Mel Gibson on board.
What are the odds of that? They're still going to shoot it digitally in like 12 days in Romania or something. So I don't know. I mean, the guy they've got directing it, I think he's an Australian director who just released a film called Red Hill, I think, a couple of years ago. I actually saw that and it was pretty decent for what it was trying to
do. I saw
it
too.
But, I mean, it's the third Expendables movie. I feel like if it hasn't gotten the blood pumping yet, it probably won't. Despite some impressive names in that cast, I guess. But I feel like I know what I'm going to get from all of those people.
Now that you've been around the block twice with this.
I mean, like, what is Harrison Ford going to bring in that movie other than his sort of half-asleep, grumpy thing that he's been doing since, I don't know, 1999? Like, what else is there? What other tricks does he have? He has no other tricks. The only wild card in that bunch is Mel Gibson, who seems to be wanting to rehabilitate his image by playing villains in over-the-top action movies. He's also the villain in Machete Kills, which comes out this fall.
And looks equally cheap as the Expendables movies.
Right.
It's unfortunate, though, because you have these names and you would think that old action fans, and you know those people exist out there who are also directors, respectable directors, you would think that that would attract them to a project like this. Now, obviously, if they're bringing all these names in, that means they're going to have to cut costs surrounding in other departments of the filmmaking process. So that means that we can't really afford the likes of so-and-so who could deliver us a pretty polished and good-looking action movie on film, for that matter, and not shot in Canada or Romania or wherever they're going to shoot this movie to double it for something else. But, you know, I still feel kind of excited when I see all these names here at one time. But it just feels like with these past two movies, which haven't been that good, Expendables 2 was a slight improvement over the first movie, but it feels like they've wasted these people so far. Especially,
I don't disagree with that at all.
Yeah.
And the thing is, like, drawing a bigger name director or a more respected director to this project is unlikely because it's not an auteur-driven picture in the sense that you can point to the director as the main creative force behind it, unless that director was Sylvester Stallone, you know, because he's sort of the guy making all of this happen. And he did direct the first film. I'm not really sure why he didn't direct the second film, other than the fact that it probably wouldn't have been easy for him to star in and direct a movie every time at bat. But why doesn't he just seize control in every single aspect of this film, other than just making all of the decisions behind the line? I don't know.
Well, it just makes you sit back and wonder, where is John McTiernan when you need him? Right. Oh, right, in prison.
I think the reason that this sort of megastar team-up has never happened before this point is because it's not in service to any story or plot worth a damn. You just have to go out of your way, like in The Expendables 2 and with Chuck Norris, to fit all these guys in there. And after a while, it's just a cavalcade of who's going to pop up in what unlikely scenario next.
I'm surprised, too, we haven't heard that Jean-Claude Van Damme will be back as the good twin brother of the bad guy from Expendables 2, because we know he has plenty of experience in the action B-movie twin genre. So
I'd actually be okay with that. That would be innovative and fine with me.
Last bit of news here. Now You See Me, this magician heist movie that I did not see, it's been reported that it will get a sequel coming up in the next couple of years based on its pretty impressive box office. It's turned a pretty impressive profit domestically and worldwide. The movie Red got a sequel this year. I did not go see that either. I don't know if you saw Red 2.
I think it disappointed at the box office.
The first one,
I didn't see it.
The first one, I guess, made enough to merit a Red 2, although I haven't talked to many people other than maybe my uncle who liked Red and couldn't wait for Red 2. But a sequel for a movie that we love, Pacific Rim, and that we talked about on the last show, remains in doubt, despite its worldwide gross now surpassing $340 million. Now, these movies are getting sequels, and we have to sit back and wait and see from Warner Brothers to see if Pacific Rim will get one, a film that was highly original and has made money at this point and is under the direction and vision of a guy like Guillermo del Toro. This is the film that deserves a franchise and deserves another movie, especially if those guys want to make another one. But you have to think, what went wrong? I mean, I'm sure that the game plan was for this to happen at some point if things went well, but you've got to wonder, marketing-wise, did they underplay Pacific Rim during its marketing campaign? Were they too heavily focused at Warner Brothers and Legendary on getting Man of Steel out there, and did they let Pacific Rim sort of sit by the wayside? What do you think? I mean, it just doesn't really seem right to me that Pacific Rim has to kind of wait and see.
Well, you know, money talks.
It's talking, though.
Yeah, well, Now You See Me and even the first Red, while not exactly cheap films, were reasonably cheap enough so that their success leads to a greater profit margin. I mean, I would guess, and I saw Now You See Me, and it's terrible, but the fact that it grossed over $100 million domestically, inexplicably, because it's so terrible. Just, if you can make it a sequel with it reasonably the same budget, which I would estimated about $60 million without looking at it, and get that sort of return again, I'd make that bet as a money man. Pacific Rim, what, cost like $190 million? And you factor in whatever the marketing costs were, it might break even. It might break even worldwide. I don't think it's going to turn a significant profit. And if you're looking at making a Pacific Rim sequel, you'd have to figure, well, it'd have to cost at least as much as the first movie, if not a little more. That said, I mean, I agree with you. If I'm looking to sequelize any movie this summer, besides The Conjuring, which would be amazing, and I think they've already announced it, it'd be Pacific Rim all the way. But that being said, I don't know. I mean, I don't know if it's a safe bet for a studio to make that choice when you have sure things you can spend money on, like a Batman versus Superman fiasco, or Pirates of the Caribbean 5, or what have you. Different studio. But
other than the lack of an A-list star, I'm still kind of wondering what it is the market wanted from Pacific Rim that they didn't get, and what made them make the decision not to go see the movie in as much of a hurry as you and I did. Again, no stars, but big deal. It's happened before where movies have succeeded without them, and we're kind of still in this age of film succeeding without a movie star necessarily, where a movie star doesn't necessarily sell a film every single time, as was proven, I think, this summer with one of the most reliable names in the industry, with Will Smith in the movie After Earth, which was not a significant hit. I think it made back what it needed to worldwide. But I think Adam Sandler seems to be the only guy who can still sort of guarantee a movie.
Well, even last summer, he missed pretty big with That's My Boy, which didn't even make back its production cost.
It is frustrating, and I just wonder if the studio necessarily did all it could do from a marketing standpoint for Pacific Rim, and it still performed in a way that it has, where it may turn what you say might not be a significant profit, but a profit. So if we concentrate our efforts a little bit more the next time, maybe it does a little bit better. I don't know. But I just hope that it does get made. And if we're left with this one Pacific Rim movie that goes a little underappreciated by the masses, then I guess I'll be fine with that, because I'll know that I was there and I experienced it twice in a theater and I knew what people were missing.
I mean, I think it's one of those things like the Hellboy movie that's going to pick up an audience on home video, because for whatever reason, I guess childlike sense of awe does not get across in marketing these days, unless you have a name star or a name brand like Man of Steel or Star Trek or what have you. But I think that people will take a chance to rent it, and I think they'll discover this is better than I expected the giant robots versus giant monsters movie to be, and has more to say about the contemporary landscape even than movies like Star Trek Into Darkness and Elysium, which are ostensibly allegories for the contemporary landscape. I don't know. I mean, I like Pacific Rim very much, and I'd be dismayed if it didn't find an audience, but I think it will, even if not in theaters.
We're trying to get home.
What is going on?
Next stop, Fruitvale Station.
You're gonna go to Frisco, right? See the fireworks?
Yeah. You ain't gonna say bye?
Bye.
Love you too.
Everything's changing around me, and I wanna change.
Hey, what's up, girl?
It's now or never.
I'm trying to get back on my feet. I really need this job.
I hired somebody else.
I feel different today.
What'd you do today?
I could start over fresh, but it ain't working out.
I'm scared. I hear guns.
Those are firecrackers. You're safe inside.
What about you, Daddy?
We'll be back before you wake up. I'm gonna be fine.
Put that phone away.
Where you at? Are you still on the train?
We're still at Fruitvale.
Why can't you tell me what is going on? What is the problem? What did you do? Oh my God.
I'm good.
Well, films that aren't quite as big as Pacific Rim and some of the other titles that we've been talking about are what we've seen since we recorded our last show. And one of those is Ryan Coogler's film, debut film, I should say, from the 26 or 27-year-old young filmmaker, Fruitvale Station, which tells the story of a young man in the Oakland Bay Area who, and I know that I hate to say like this is a spoiler, but I mean this is real life. People know what happened in this young man's life, where he suffered tragedy at the BART station in Oakland, California with his friends on New Year's morning. The film stars Michael B. Jordan as Oscar, and we are just sort of dropped as voyeurs in the day in the life of this young man's seemingly troubled but perhaps rehabilitated life, where he is not necessarily a saint as some people might predict this movie would portray him. In fact, it's quite the opposite. This is a guy who is troubled and has a dark past, and he's somebody who's trying to correct himself. And there are obstacles presented to him throughout this day that show him, while he's trying to correct himself and make himself a better person for his girlfriend and his very young daughter, there are still things that are preventing him from doing that from a behavioral standpoint, things that he's trying to overcome psychologically and as an adult, and he's having trouble doing so, even though he does have a strong base of support from his family, who obviously love him, and again, from his girlfriend and his daughter. But you can't always predict circumstances, and life just happens, and you have to face those circumstances and deal with them as best you can, and sometimes unfortunate things happen. But I found myself extremely moved by this movie, even though it's told in a relatively unsentimental fashion. I was extremely impressed with Coogler, who really doesn't reinforce his presence throughout this movie. It's stylish in some regards, just in that it's told in sort of this sort of verite style, just hyper-realistic fashion. I didn't feel manipulated at all during this movie, especially in this time where we're seeing people in such heated debate over something like the Trayvon Martin, George Zimmerman incident and subsequent trial. This movie seems extremely timely, and it seems like it would be on the tips of people's tongues, especially as it was released when it was in the past few weeks since that trial. But this movie, I don't think politicizes anything about the incident, even though it does open with the real footage of what happened at the station. I think that, if anything, it humanizes the character, and I think that it deserves major applause for doing so. And you've got a guy like Michael B. Jordan, who's an extremely likable actor, but he's portraying this guy, I think, with a pretty rare sincerity and honesty that you don't see in a movie like this. I think that other filmmakers would have chosen to tell Oscar's story in a more sentimental fashion, in that they would say, this is a guy who didn't deserve what he got, and these guys are the bad guys for doing it. But it tends to tell both sides of the story and tell it as objectively as it possibly can. But it's all sad, unfortunately. But again, I think that it's told in a really beautiful way.
I like the movie a lot, too. I found it, as you mentioned, to be a movie for the moment, you know, when I saw it right in the aftermath of the George Zimmerman verdict. And I think one thing Fruitvale Station offers to the discussion, the continued discussion in the fallout from that, is a sense of humanity, like you said, and empathy. I'm kind of embarrassed to tell you how many times I heard or read on the internet people type something like, well, Trayvon Martin obviously was asking for it by walking where he was, dressed how he was, talking back to George Zimmerman, starting an argument, any number of things, as if to somehow say that the young man, though he was killed, might have deserved it on some level. Justification like, well, you know, when he was a student in school, he had marijuana in his backpack, and he obviously had a history with drugs, as if that somehow justifies somebody coming up after whatever it is that happened, shooting this young man to death. Now, it's interesting that Fruitvale Station comes along then and presents a fully realized portrait of a human being who has troubles, who has joys, who has strengths and weaknesses, who has his own life and loves and passions and weak points and moments where he's at fault for things that he does, and regret and problems all throughout the course of the day that the film depicts in Oscar Grant's life. And so you have Michael B. Jordan stepping into this real figure's shoes and inhabiting this young man and all of his complexities. And it's a terrific performance that is as complex, even though it's not as showy or as filled with outward action as many performances these days are. It's as complex as anything I've seen recently, perhaps even more so because he's not driving a speedboat trying to shoot at drug dealers in Miami or something like that. You know, he's just a normal guy with a normal day. And the fact that you get a sense of this full human being and come to empathize with him through, like you said, the cinema verite, almost kind of Paul Greengrass style, I thought was exceptional. Now I won't totally go with you that it's entirely unmanipulative, because I think that Ryan Coogler stacks the deck a little bit in some scenes, not to a fault, not to be harmful or distracting to the film, because honestly, if we're living in a culture where people think that a young man deserved to be killed because at one point in his life he brought marijuana to school, maybe the deck needs to be stacked. Maybe the point needs to be brought home that these are human beings, that this violence against other human beings, I mean, who have their own complex lives, is absurd.
I think that's what gets lost in these discussions, is that a human being's life was lost, and you don't take the time to really absorb that and appreciate that. Instead, they become symbols,
right,
and they become debate topics, and not someone's loved one who was killed. And people would argue nonsensically. Others would say that it was justified. And if you want to debate that, that's fine. In the case of Trayvon Martin and George Zimmerman, I can say that personally, I don't know. I don't know all the facts. I wasn't there to see what happened, and nobody really ever will. It's all based on these testimonies that people gave, and they weren't convincing enough for a jury to find somebody guilty of that specific crime. But in the case of Fruitvale Station and Oscar Grant, there were a lot of people there, and there were people who were recording the incident with their cell phone, and so you see what happens. You don't necessarily hear everything. It's not totally audible to where you can hear everything that's going on, but there was a train full of people who were watching this young person get shot by a policeman who claimed that he was trying to retrieve his taser and instead discharged his firearm. And if that was the case, it's unfortunate that that happened. But what I find admirable about this movie and the way Coogler tells the story, this isn't, again, necessarily the most innocent guy who was put in this situation. He had the deck stacked against him in many ways, but he was a guy who probably did a lot of that stacking too, because there's an incident that takes place on the train on New Year's Eve and New Year's morning that is not primarily but partially his responsibility, and he plays a large part in the incident happening and subsequently police coming to the station and sitting him down. But we see throughout the day this is a guy who is a drug dealer. This is someone who's been in prison before. We talk about how troubled his life has been up to this point, but it's also somebody who's trying to leave that life behind. And this is somebody who is a good son and a good father and a good boyfriend to those who love him and a good grandson. There are these really touching scenes where he's spending time with his family at what will eventually be his last meal. There are just things throughout the day that show how full his life and a human being's life is in just the span of almost 24 hours. It's amazing how much you see. And I don't know if it's all true necessarily. There are things like on the train, for instance, and things that happen throughout the day that seem a little bit contrived. Again, you're talking about the deck being stacked, especially the incident that happens on the train.
I think the blonde woman he runs into throughout the day, I think that's a
fake
character.
Yeah. That would make sense.
That's the thing that kind of struck me as the biggest contrivance.
That too, and also, yeah, the actual incident that takes place on the train, that seems awfully convenient.
Right, I'm sure that's exaggerated for dramatic effect.
Yeah, and it works, and like you said, there is a little bit of manipulation there, but I think for the most part, this movie does it the right way and raises the right questions. I mean, the closing credits can feel a little manipulative at times. I remember when I was in the theater, and it talks about the aftermath of the incidents and what happened in the trial, and I heard a person in the audience above me just audibly say, "Wow," in reaction to that. So they're trying to obviously get a rise out of people, but they're also just trying to tell the story of this young person. And again, where I think this movie really succeeds is that it is beyond being a debate point and being a talking point, and it tells the story of this person who lost his life, and you can make a judgment one way or the other whether or not he deserved what happened to him. There are some people out there who would argue that if a police officer or somebody in a position of authority tells you what to do, you should sit there and you should comply, right? And you shouldn't argue and you shouldn't put yourself in a dangerous position. You should sit there and wait it out, then, you know, make your case later. And in the case of Oscar Grant or Trayvon Martin, people would say that he didn't do that. He fought authority and he risked his own life, and He got what was coming to him. That's what some people think, and others think that that's ridiculous, and they may or may not be right. But again, this movie, it really asks a lot of difficult questions. But at the same time, I think you'll find yourself being absorbed by the life of this person and what's happening, and you find yourself rooting for them just to do the right thing. And that isn't always the case with this character, Oscar Grant, in Ryan Coogler's movie. But I'm extremely impressed by his level of filmmaking at such a young age. I think this is an impressive debut, and I will definitely be there for the next Ryan Coogler movie. I listened to an interview that he had with Elvis Mitchell in the show The Treatment on KCRW, and it's just really fascinating to hear a young person like that talk. He's somebody who obviously loves movies and loves filmmakers and is not afraid to wear his heart on his sleeve from a just purely movie-loving standpoint. He drops names, people who have influenced him. He talks about movies like A Prophet and 4 months, 3 weeks, and 2 days as being direct influences on this movie. And
I can see that.
Yeah.
And particularly with 4 months, 3 weeks, and 2 days.
Yeah, definitely. I see ODR, too, as an influence on the work that he's done. But I think it's great to see just this young filmmaker coming out, somebody who has a passion for movie making and can tell, you know, somebody his age who can tell a story with as much restraint as he does in this movie. So I'm a fan. I liked it. And I do agree with you that it, in the end, yeah, it isn't totally non-manipulative, but I was affected by the parts that weren't necessarily.
Right. I think it works well enough either way. Worth seeing. I don't know if it's still going to be playing by the time this comes out. Maybe it is.
I'm just glad that it came here anyway. Yeah. You know, it was timely, and it probably should be seen by a lot more people. I think around here, too, I think people would really dig it. But a movie that did not come here in theaters or in many theaters at all, and understandably so, is Nicholas Winding Refn's movie Only God Forgives, which is available, I think, still on demand. And this is the new film from Nicholas Winding Refn. He's following up Drive. This is a movie that was on, I think, each of our lists for most anticipated of the year.
I don't think it was on mine. Might have been. Might have been an honorable mention.
But I can imagine that you were looking forward to it, just in that it was the new Refn. You're a big fan of Drive. And here he is with this story about a pair of drug-dealing brothers in Bangkok, Thailand, in the seedy underbelly, probably the seediest, most disgusting underbelly I've seen in recent memory depicted on film. One of them is killed, and the other feels compelled to right the wrong once his blood-sucking mother comes into town and essentially forces him to find vengeance for his brother, who ain't exactly an angel and definitely had what was coming to him in this movie. But it's really sort of hard to explain this film from a plot standpoint or any standpoint. But this is one of just the most unusual films I've seen in a long time. We've talked about Spring Breakers this year as being sort of this nightmare on film. This one sort of does a number on Spring Breakers in terms of just presenting this world that I personally have never seen in any movie like it. I've not seen a movie like it, and I think that that's probably the biggest compliment you can pay to this movie, or perhaps in your case, the only compliment that you can pay to this movie, unless you have seen something like it. But I'll say it, Corey, I loved Only God Forgives.
And
I think that this is a movie that you're either going to love a whole lot or really hate. And I see more hate out there than I do love at this point. But let me ask you this question, and we'll get into why we loved or hated this movie. But I see a lot of people out there, esteemed critics even, who have written about this movie, and there were reports that this was booed at Cannes. I never really believed those reports, to be honest with you, but there are people who have written that Only God Forgives is unwatchable.
I don't think it's unwatchable. I think it's terrible, I don't think it's unwatchable.
Okay, so explain yourself. How can you consider this movie terrible?
Let me deliver my plot summary. Since you've already done that,
okay,
here's my version. Only God Forgives, directed by Nicholas Winding Refn, is a film about a particularly inexpressive mannequin with mommy issues who wanders around neon-lit Thailand moping for an interminable 90 minutes. Meanwhile, the world's most obvious metaphor for death stalks him and other do-batters through this hellscape of a seedy underbelly of this city as prostitutes and various other thugs assort themselves about Refn's frame like a second-rate Kubrick imitation, which is what this is, given the director of photography, Larry Smith, also worked on Eyes Wide Shut, if you were wondering why this looks like it. Meanwhile, Cliff Martinez drones on the soundtrack. Everybody mopes and stares directly into the camera lens, and Kristen Scott Thomas, God bless her, shows up and just, she's the worst. She's terrible in this movie. I can't even describe how bad she is because she comes on it with all of this profanity and inspires Oedipal anxiety in the particularly inexpressive mannequin, culminating in the worst, the worst return to the womb metaphor made literal ever, ever.
Yeah, I had heard that that was a slight improvisation on the part of Ryan Gosling that you're mentioning, or at least the scene was his idea.
He should have not had that idea.
Well, anyway, I don't understand how you can say that this is a second-rate Kubrick movie. I think
it's second-rate Kubrick.
Well, now this is you're not going to see a better-looking movie in 2013 than Only God Forgives.
I've seen several.
No, nothing is going
to. Would you like for me to list them?
Nothing's going to look better. You might think something looks as good, but this movie is just so beautiful from a visual standpoint that I find it impossible to argue that. I don't see how you
can
say...
I like neon lights too.
Oh, but well, I don't know. Like every single frame is lush and is framed perfectly. It looks
perfectly like Kubrick.
Well, what's wrong with that?
There's nothing wrong with it. Just, you know, own up to it. If you're Nicholas Winding Refn, this is your attempt at a Kubrick movie.
Okay, can you say the same thing? I think that this is similar in style and it's sort of visual complexion as Drive or Bronson or some of the other films that he's made. You really don't think so?
I think it might have. No, I don't think it is. Maybe a little bit for Drive, but not Bronson. Bronson's no.
Bronson has those very slow push-ins and slow cross dissolves. And I don't know. I see a lot of similarities stylistically between this and the rest of Refn's work, especially those recent movies.
Well, visually, but those movies also remembered to give us a compelling character worth a damn.
Compelling character worth a damn. Okay. Well, for instance, you say it's the most obvious death metaphor that you've seen in a while, but we're talking about this character who I believe is a Thai actor, and I'm going to really mispronounce his name unless you know how.
I don't.
Vithaya Panzangarm. I'm sorry, sir. I just butchered that. Yeah,
please
but,
don't chop off his hands.
Yeah, no, I think he probably would for that. But no, I think that he's excellent, and I think he's one of the best characters of the year, one of Refn's best characters.
Understand. How can you read excellence into a performance like that when he's called upon to glower in the direction of the camera?
Mm-hmm.
You think the glowering is exceptional?
I do, in this case. I think it is.
But there's no there. I think that there. He conveys, they're not doing anything.
I think he conveys just a completely frightening and unpredictable character that Refn was totally going for. I think everyone and everything about this realizes this vision that Refn has, which I find extremely unique and exciting.
I feel like I could replicate that vision by lighting this room we're in with neon, getting a cardboard cutout of somebody, and slowly pushing into the cardboard cutout's face while pulses and it's on the soundtrack.
Well, you know, maybe you don't like the style, but I think that this movie does have a lot to say, especially in terms of morality. This movie is all about morality and doing the right thing and righting the wrongs that you have committed in your life and becoming a good person and shedding the evil things that you have done.
And I think it's very generous of you to have read into the movie that way because it certainly does not have anything to say like that.
Oh, it absolutely does in almost literal senses throughout the movie. You had already referenced cutting the hands off of myself here for the wrong that I did then in pronouncing that actor's name. But no, I mean, you have situations where you have these characters who are presented these moral quandaries. We mentioned the brother character who is killed by this man whose daughter, and I don't think it's too much of a spoiler to say whose daughter that he has raped and killed. And I think she was like a 13 or 16-year-old girl that this just deplorable character has raped and murdered in this figure. And I would argue in some cases that you could make the case that this is more of a godlike figure than a death figure in this movie. He gives this man, who is the father of this murdered girl, the opportunity to avenge his daughter's death and murder the man who murdered her.
No, you're right, because he is more of a godlike figure, and throughout the film, it returns to this darkened corridor that the Gosling figure in his dreams is afraid to enter for fear of what's inside, which would be
his punishment.
His punishment or judgment.
That's right.
From this God figure.
Right.
Okay.
And I find that incredibly compelling. I find it compelling from a thematic standpoint, and I think that he does it in as interesting a visual way that you possibly can. And again, I find it totally unique. And if we're talking about borrowing from other filmmakers, I think Kubrick is definitely there, again, from a stylistic standpoint.
Yeah, I mean,
but the director here that I think he mostly resembles is David Lynch.
I was afraid you were
going to
say that.
This is like Refn doing Lynch without doing Lynch necessarily. It doesn't play out like Twin Peaks or Mulholland Drive would, I think, in the end, but that was the feeling that I got, again, from kind of like a stylistic standpoint.
But again, David Lynch, at least in his films, has some sort of recognizable human to latch onto every time. Because you've got to have some way for the audience to connect
with your
film.
This isn't Fruitvale Station, though. You know,
this isn't
necessarily realistic. And these are monsters, I think, that he's really portraying here, especially in the brother and the mother character that we talked about. But you have this character in Julian, yes, who has internalized seemingly everything about himself.
Yes.
But I think there's a reason for that, because you have someone who's full of rage and you have someone who is full of regret and has trouble expressing himself for fear that he's going to do something wrong. He's going to do something bad and he will be judged in a way that he is fearful of. And what I found interesting about that is he's trying to shed that about himself. He did not choose who his mother was and what family he came from. And he's doing, I think, everything in his power to rid himself of that identity. And I think that Refn has himself a good character. And yes, Ryan Gosling does sit there and stare into nowhere several times during this movie. But again, I think that the internalization of that character is deliberate, and I think it's profound.
Sure. Well, what you said, I think, is valid. Is it compelling to watch? Is there enough externalized anything to make this worth the slog that it takes to sit through it? The answer is no. I mean, at least in Drive, where you have a similar character in Ryan Gosling, who is another quiet sort of... I mean, for all intents and purposes, the character in Drive could fulfill the same character description that you just gave for Julian. But the difference is that that character is playing off of recognizably human other characters, like Carey Mulligan's character, like even Bryan Cranston. You know, he is surrounded by more than just types.
Corny, overplayed characters.
And
I think that this movie doesn't have the flaws that Drive had, to be honest with you. And I love Drive. I really do.
I think that
there are cartoonish elements to that movie, specifically with the broadly drawn characters that you just mentioned, that don't totally work for me.
I don't think that Carey Mulligan's character is broadly drawn at all, but okay, but fine. I think that Drive is playing to a very specific Hollywood crime movie archetype by putting this quiet, internalized character in the midst of it. I think that Only God Forgives strands its quiet, internalized character in a sea of garishness and uncompelling non-action, inaction. It's an inert film for me.
No.
It's like an empty box that is wonderfully wrapped and designed with hundreds upon hundreds of neon lights.
I heard somebody put it saying, thank God Only God Forgives, keeping the red light bulb industry in business.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's great. But look, I happen to like the way the red lights light this movie. I think it's cool. You know, I think that at least from that standpoint, you can say, wow, that was at least a cool looking movie. I'm surprised you can't appreciate it on that level, at least. And I think that it totally serves the movie.
I think that after a point, I need something other than, well, at least it looks cool. And there's just nothing to sink one's teeth into this.
Oh, this movie is full of things to sink your teeth into. This is a movie you've got to peel back layer by layer. There are some obvious metaphors that you've already mentioned. You mentioned the womb thing, which I could have done without. I think that the movie, from a storytelling standpoint, succeeded without that, and it was a little bit over the top. Maybe not a little bit over the top. It was very over the top. But I actually like this performance from Ryan Gosling, even though there are a lot of people out there saying, well, he just doesn't do anything. There is no performance. He stands there, and Nicholas Winding Refn presses record as he sits there and looks into nowhere.
I'm one of those people, yes.
I think it's a shame. And I go back to this actor whose name I will not mispronounce this time because I won't say it. I'm just going to say that guy, the guy who plays the retired cop who doles out this punishment throughout the movie, I think it's a wonderful performance where he is also in many ways internalizing, similarly isolated the Ryan Gosling character, but I don't think he has to really express himself, even though he does. Each time after he doles out this punishment on these unsavory characters, he goes to this karaoke bar and sings a song, it seems, and which I found hilarious, and sings in front of these military men who are sitting in this ridiculously designed bar. I thought that was great. I don't know. I found things to laugh at with this movie, even though that it's not expressly a comedy. But I don't know, man. I just think that thematically there is a lot to chew on and plenty to appreciate, especially, again, if we're talking about the story that it's trying to tell about morality and about trying to shed this bad image and this horrible black soul that has been sort of implanted in you from birth and you didn't really have a chance from the beginning, and trying again to do the right thing for once in your life and see if you can find some sort of salvation from that. And I think that this movie is going for it, and I think it achieves it.
I think that what you described is a lot more interesting than
this is what happens in Only God Forgives. This is how it works.
I think you're being very generous by picking up all of that from that movie.
What about the hit scene when they try to put a hit out on the retired cop character? That wasn't exciting for you. You found nothing about this movie? You didn't enjoy anything?
No, that was a good scene. And I'm not saying I didn't enjoy anything.
Cliff Martinez's score you didn't like?
It was pretty okay.
You said drones on.
It does tend to drone on. It was an okay score. He's done better work.
Go back and watch it, Corey, please.
I don't think that I'll take that time anytime soon, but I'm glad that you enjoyed it because you were looking forward to it so much.
Well, look, I can say I didn't love something I was really looking forward to. We know that. This is not the case with Only God Forgives.
Okay.
I love it. People go see it or watch it anyway.
My father, he said to read Romans. All things work together for good. He believed that. Will you pray with me?
I had no faith.
On DVD this week, Corey, there is a movie that it took me a while to see. It was playing on demand too, and we'll talk about what else is on DVD, but finally it came on Redbox. Unfortunately, the Blu-ray copy was not available,
yeah. So
I had to watch this on poor, shoddy DVD, at least on a Blu-ray player.
I think it deprived you of the primary pleasure of the movie.
I'm sure it did, but we're talking about Terrence Malick's most recent film, To the Wonder, which stars Olga Kurylenko, Ben Affleck, and Rachel McAdams, and Javier Bardem. And if you had problems with people not really doing much of anything and Only God Forgives, then Lord knows what you thought of the performances in Terrence Malick's movie, To the Wonder, because I know that there are a lot of people who similarly had a poor reaction to this. And the way people described this movie was like any other Terrence Malick movie I'd seen up to this point. It sounded like a Terrence Malick movie. It looked like one. It sounded like one. And people described it as such. But this time, for whatever reason, it didn't work for them, and they found it to be crap. And I've never once in my life had that feeling about a Terrence Malick movie, and at no point have I ever thought that I could feel that way about a Terrence Malick movie. And so once I finally saw this, I still don't feel that way about a Terrence Malick movie. I think that this movie is just achingly beautiful in parts, and while it is tough to discern, given that this is as artful of a movie as you can find, and I find incredible that people at the Cannes Film Festival wouldn't enjoy it or at least appreciate it on some level. Look, it's abstract, and it's probably the most abstract movie he's ever made, even more so than Tree of Life. It's really hard to reach some of the characters at times, even though you're seemingly inside their subconscious. As you've seen in so many of his movies, you have this narration that works more like stream of consciousness than anything else. But I found it to just be a difficult, sort of heart-wrenching love story that he was telling, or non-love story, as it were, about a couple of people who may or may not should be together and should raise a child together in different parts of the world. And there are people who struggle not only with their lives and their relationship, but also with their faith. And you have this other character in the movie who struggles with his faith. And this is a priest played by Javier Bardem, and what is a sort of unconventional role and difficult role, I think, for a lot of people to chew on. But for me, Corey, this is just Terrence Malick being Terrence Malick, and it worked for me in ways that so many of his other films have too. Again, there's a lot to chew on here, and this deserves rewatches. But again, we talked about every frame being beautiful. In my experience with Only God Forgives, you can say that, and then some with To the Wonder. This is a gorgeous film, and there's just so much about it that is just lovely, and so much about it that is challenging as well.
Yeah, I'm hesitant to be terribly committal either way with this one, because I've only seen it once, and it was when it first was on demand back in April, I guess. And it didn't do much for me, but I was sort of troubled by my response to it and knew that I needed to dig back into it. But like you've said, it is typically, for Terrence Malick, a gorgeous, gorgeous movie. It is one, however, that I kind of did not find the beating heart in, as I found in, well, all of his other movies, particularly The Tree of Life, which I've gone on at length about on this show before and is fast becoming one of my favorite movies. This movie seems a bit more distanced from everybody in it, even though, like you said, primarily you have Olga Kurylenko providing this stream of consciousness voiceover about the nature of love and romantic relationships, but also I think love with a capital L in the universe and from whatever God might be, and typically heady philosophical cosmic thoughts from Terrence Malick. I feel like those are Terrence Malick's stream of consciousness thoughts and not necessarily the characters, if that makes sense, because I don't know that we get enough of a sense of any of these characters, despite their troubled romantic lives, to make any sort of analysis about them, with possible exception of Javier Bardem, whose plight is pretty plainly illustrated by his voiceover. That being said, there is a fascinating thing that Malick does in this movie by sort of drawing his characterization from the surroundings that his characters are in, or their occupations. Ben Affleck, for example, as best you can figure, is an emotionally distant sort of person. But you notice throughout the film that he is living in a series of unfurnished houses, these nice new constructions with nothing going on inside.
It's like subdivisions.
Yeah. And his job is to apparently to test groundwater for any insidious chemicals that might be lurking within. So, I mean, I think there's some fascinating stuff, fascinating metaphor into The Wonder. It's just, unfortunately, much like Only God Forgives for me, it's difficult to care or latch on to anything beyond that intellectual sense, other than the pure visual overload, the sensory, wonderful trip that you're taken on by Malick, as you'd expect. That being said, again, this is due for a rewatch, and it's very possible, if not likely, that I'll find more about it to respond to.
Yeah, it's probably Terrence Malick's coldest movie.
Yeah, I think
to
so.
Date. But that's on the surface. And I think that even though this is an incredibly tough nut to crack, I think once you start to, and I guess through your own interpretation of it, then there's really a lot to enjoy other than the visual splendor of it. And there's plenty of that to go around. But we're all three of us in this room married individuals. You know, we have wives, and I feel like that this movie at times can be difficult for a married person to watch, where you're watching this romance sort of bloom and then also deteriorate. And I think that the point of this movie, in some respects, is that love is, it's not easy, and relationships are not easy. And when you have this character of Javier Bardem sort of preaching this scripture that sort of mandates people to embrace love and embrace the challenge of it, I don't think that he is finding it to be the case in his own personal life. And what he's seeing when he goes out into the physical world, he's seeing the opposite of what he's saying, and he's finding it hard to believe. And I think that the Ben Affleck and Olga Kurylenko characters who form this union throughout the movie, I think that they found it incredibly easy to fall in love on the surface, but they're finding it incredibly difficult to maintain it, and love isn't what they thought it would be. Once they leave Paris and go to Oklahoma, where he is working at this job that you had mentioned. And if you can't, I think this sort of part of the point of it is this has to work in Paris, where anybody can fall in love and is sort of like the city where people fall in love and is totally romanticized. But you also have to, you have to succeed in Oklahoma and in this environment where the subdivision is, where it is boring for some of the characters in the movie, and where you have to endure more than you have to really sort of embrace. And I found it fascinating. And again, I found it really tough because there are things in this movie that the characters do that end up having them straying from this bond that they seemingly have. And it's hard to watch that as somebody who's married and wants people to succeed at what they're setting out to do. But, you know, like any other Terrence Malick movie, you're right. You got to see it multiple times to truly appreciate the nature of it and the beauty of it. And speaking of nature and beauty, he certainly doesn't stray from that common theme that we've seen in his filmography up to this point. There's just nothing Terrence Malick doesn't love about the outside in his films. And I think Emmanuel Lubezki is back for this, right?
Yes.
And he's the cinematographer. And I mean, this is just as pretty to look at as Tree of Life was. And, you know, it's in some ways told on a grander scale. Outside of the opening sequence of Tree of Life, I don't think you can get any grander than that. But I loved it. I really did. And, I found a lot to appreciate about it. And it really, again, this is one that boggles my mind that Terrence Malick fans specifically can't latch onto immediately.
Right. Yeah, it was tough for me, unexpectedly tough. But I'm going to give it another look at some point, hopefully soon.
Well, this is now available on DVD and, more importantly, Blu-ray, which I was not afforded the opportunity to see it.
Preferred format, I would say, for most Terrence Malick movies. Now that they're all on Blu-ray with this and the recent Criterion release of Badlands,
which I picked up.
I did too.
At Barnes & Noble. Yeah,
I
during
haven't had a chance to watch it yet.
The 50% off sale. I've got it now, and I was going to mention the other Criterions I picked up. I got Shallow Grave.
Yeah.
The Danny Boyle debut, which I really like a lot. That movie's great. And I had a blind buy. I bought Brian De Palma's movie Blowout.
Did you like it?
I haven't watched it yet.
Oh, man, it's so good.
Well, you know, it's a movie I've always wanted to see. You've heard, you know, people like you, and there are filmmakers out there who have really responded well to it, and they love it and recommend it. And it's a movie that's been elusive for me. And once I saw that Criterion cover staring at me when I was looking at those DVDs, I just said, you know what, let's do this. And it might pay off, and it might blow up in my face, but we'll see what happens. But was Badlands your only purchase?
I picked up Guillermo del Toro's The Devil's Backbone too.
I've got that on Netflix right now.
Nice.
But I haven't watched it yet.
Yeah, it's great. It's my favorite of his movies. I think I said that last time.
Yeah, I watched Kronos not too long ago and enjoyed that.
Yeah, it's enjoyable.
Yeah, for sure. It's a fun debut, an unconventional vampire movie.
Yeah.
But is there anything else on DVD that's worth mentioning?
Well, last week with To the Wonder was a big release week. The Place Beyond the Pines saw its release. We talked about that, I guess, the last show or the show before in brief, but worth seeing even if its pieces don't entirely coalesce for you. Tom Cruise's movie Oblivion, which I know friends of the show are a lot higher on than me, though I did watch it again on Blu-ray and had a better time with it, if only for on its visual level, though I, again, do not think that it's a particularly interesting or innovative or anything special about it, really, piece of storytelling, but decent for a watch. Also, well, of course, one of my favorite movies of the year, Jeff Nichols' Mud, is on DVD and Blu-ray. Definitely check that out. And the documentary West of Memphis, which chronicles in painstaking detail the case of the West Memphis Three that was otherwise chronicled in the Paradise Lost films. I hadn't seen any of those movies, so everything was totally new to me with West of Memphis, and it is a terrific, terrific true crime documentary movie. Well worth seeing. Very long, though, 2.5 hours long.
Yeah, I've seen at least one of the Paradise Lost movies, the third one, which is sort of the very emotional climax of that trilogy, and it's just an unbelievable story, and I'm sure it culminates pretty well in that documentary, West of Memphis. Opening in theaters nationwide this week, it's a pretty crummy crop, if you ask me, although I think I'm interested enough in seeing Kick-Ass 2. I was more of a fan of the first movie than you were, and I'm at least anxious to see someone who's not a fan on principle at this point of the movie, Jim Carrey's performance in it. You know, I'm just hoping to see that guy do something good again. And I think based on what I've seen in the trailer, he's at least trying something in this late part of his career, which you can't really say about some of his other recent movies. But I'm interested at least. Jobs, this biopic of Steve Jobs, the late Steve Jobs, played here by Ashton Kutcher. Unfortunately, Paranoia, which currently has a 5% rating on Rotten Tomatoes.
Does it really?
Yeah. Well, I mean, Liam Hemsworth is the lead in this thing.
Yeah.
But Harrison Ford and Gary Oldman and Richard Dreyfuss are in this movie. Sad. I know. And then you've got Lee Daniels' movie, The Butler.
Is that the 1916 short film, The Butler? Is it? I always get confused when I hear that title. I just
well, that's why they put Lee Daniels at the front of the title.
So it's not the short film, the short silent film, The Butler from 1916. Okay. That really needed to
be clarified. What you're saying. Yeah. Now I see what you're doing. But no, it's kind of like Precious based on the novel Push by Sapphire.
Okay. I wish that somebody had said something to clarify that this was not a re-release of the 1916 silent short film, The Butler.
Well, this
which everyone knows and loves deeply.
Yeah, this is also based on the novel Push by Sapphire, so it's interesting to see what will happen there with Lee Daniels. But I like Lee Daniels. I was a big fan of Precious. The Paperboy is one of the most whacked out things I've ever seen in my life. So this guy's at least worth watching. We know that. So this one looks like a pretty sappy story, to be honest with you, the way it's been portrayed in the trailers. But I've got faith in Lee Daniels and Forrest Whitaker to do something interesting, and it'd be interesting to watch Oprah Winfrey hunt for her Oscar, the one thing I think she doesn't have.
I also have faith in Lee Daniels to do something interesting.
Yeah.
Paperboy is interesting, but oh man.
You don't feel that way about The Butler? I'm sorry, Lee Daniels the Butler?
Yeah, or...
Just, I didn't mean to confuse you. I didn't mean to confuse you just then.
Really, I don't know. I think that this is him toned down and inoffensive, which might be for the best given how bug nuts the Paperboy is. And I'm not as big of a fan of Precious as you are. I think there's some really good performances in there. But the movie has done a great disservice by him wildly changing tones and influences and doing all of that crap that he does in that movie. But I'm interested enough to see The Butler. I'm going to check it out this weekend probably, along with opening in Birmingham at the Edge 12, the very acclaimed documentary Blackfish, which deals with the controversy and tragedy of orca whales in captivity who come to harm their trainers. By all accounts, a harrowing watch, but it does look good, and it apparently is quite effective.
For fans of The Cove...
Yeah, I like The Cove a lot,
yeah.
But that's another tough watch.
What a fun double feature that would be.
As a poor segue, Blackfish is also a selection of the 2013 Sidewalk Film Festival, which will be held August 23rd through 25th in Birmingham. Now, being a resident of Birmingham, it's not that big of a deal for me just to hop on down and see four or five movies, though as an educator, I do have responsibility to my students first.
Sure.
However, I'm going to be covering Sidewalk for the Tuscaloosa News again this year, and looking forward to what looks to be one of the best lineups they've ever had, with not only Blackfish, but Ain't Them Body Saints, and Computer Chess, and a couple other things.
Muscle Shoals,
yeah, absolutely.
Want to see that one.
Definitely going to check that out. Oh, and a 35mm print of the original Texas Chainsaw Massacre on Saturday night at the Alabama Theater. I'm going to be there with bells on. You better believe it.
Check us out on aspectradio.com. Find us on Twitter at twitter.com/aspectradio or on facebook.com/aspectradio. We're on iTunes, so find us there with a quick search or click the link on our blog. Be sure to visit our friend Matt Scalici's website, filmnerds.com, where you'll now find a longer interview with Dan Aykroyd that my brother Graham conducted.
That's awesome.
Yeah, he talks to him about the 30th anniversary of Trading Places, and he even asks him about his collaborations with Steven Spielberg on movies like 1941, The Blues Brothers, and Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom, where he had a cameo, short cameo. So that's pretty neat that he was able to talk to him about that stuff. Kind of surreal, too. In time now for our parting shots.
For Film Nerds and Aspect Radio, this is Graham Flanagan in New York. If you haven't done so already, please go to filmnerds.com and check out my interview with legendary comedian and actor Dan Aykroyd. He came to Bloomberg a few weeks ago to talk about the 30th anniversary of Trading Places, and he gave me about 15 minutes just to chat with him and ask some questions that I had. So we talk about Trading Places as well as his relationship with Steven Spielberg, and that's kind of my favorite thing that came out of the interview, where he sort of talks about their relationship, which has resulted in a handful of cameos over the years. Spielberg's and Blues Brothers and Aykroyd and Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom. And then he brought Aykroyd back again for an Amblin production a few years later. And we show all those clips, and that's kind of cool. But the best part is the fact that their relationship sort of began in 1979 with Spielberg's 1941. And of course, the Film Nerds crew did a podcast on 1941. And the fact that I was able to get some time one-on-one in person with one of the main actors of that movie is sort of serendipitous, you know, so soon after we'd done the podcast. So I think it was just sort of a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity. And I know a lot of people might be mad at me for not asking questions about Coneheads or Ghostbusters, or maybe even My Stepmother is an Alien. And they might think that 1941 is a movie that's too obscure to talk about and no one really cares about it. Well, I think that it's actually very significant in terms of Steven Spielberg's career, should be looked at in his filmography. And I had to take that opportunity to do it. And I hope it serves as a nice little bonus nugget that can sort of accompany the podcast. So please go to filmnerds.com ASAP and check out the Dan Aykroyd interview. I think you'll really enjoy it. And if you haven't yet, download the epic podcast where we discuss 1941, Steven Spielberg's quote-unquote flop from 1979 that he made in between Close Encounters and Raiders. Check it out. I really think you'll enjoy it. For Film Nerds and Aspect Radio, this is Graham Flanagan in New York.
Hey guys, this is Craig in Nashville with another Aspect Radio parting shot. It just hit me that all these movie podcast names are either a play on words or a direct term related to film and filmmaking. We've got Aspect Radio right there, which is a play on words, if you will, of aspect ratio. There's also another one called The Dissolve. It got me thinking. I would like to request a movie podcast and call it Full Frame. We'll take a movie a week and for 2 hours discuss why this particular film is only available in full frame. I don't care when it was made. I just want to talk about why they haven't made it available in widescreen yet. I mean, is it so hard to take a movie and even just reshoot some scenes to tack on to the left side and the right side to make it look like widescreen? And just like, you know, for every frame, think about what the left and right sides of those scenes would be and just like rebuild sets. Throw some extras in there and refilm it, cut it, splice it, tack it on either side of the full frame. Make sure the color palette looks the same. Letterbox is already taken, or I would use that one. That one's even worse.
I was reading the paper the other morning, and I was reading about this new piece of film technology they've got on the VHS called Letterbox. It's called Letterbox. I was reading about it in the paper. And what they do is they take your regular movie screen format and they crap all over it.
Ho, ho, ho.
They take an arbitrary square from a movie that you would see on your movie theater screen, and they cut the sides off, and I guess they feed it to Cecil B. Mills' dogs.
Oh!
So all that to say, if you're going to the video store and you rent The Leopard this weekend, you'll be mainly seeing spots.
What is it going to take to make this transition for these movies? Just compress the film, push it down at the top, and then pull the left side and the right side out. So while you get shorter, fatter actors and chairs and doors and stuff, at least you can view the film in a widescreen format. Digital SL freaking R? What does that even mean? It sounds too fancy for something that's just one square. Can you imagine Pacific Rim in full frame? You might see a sea monster fist every now and then. I mean, this is the age of Avatar. This is the age of planes. We walked on the moon decades ago. Why can't we get these classic films available in widescreen in the way they were meant to be seen?
Hey guys, it's Ben Stark with Wondermill Films. Quick parting shot for this week. A friend of mine asked me to give him some advice on how he would become a better film watcher. Not necessarily a professional film critic or anything, but just how to start thinking about movies the way a film critic would. Now, I'm obviously not a film critic, but I was willing to answer his question for him, and it turned into a kind of film school essay. I haven't written this kind of thing in a long time, and it was kind of fun to get it down on paper, and I thought I would share it with you guys. So it was 3 points that I gave him, 3 ways to think about movies in the way a film critic would or should. Number one is define criticism for yourself. In my opinion, film criticism isn't consumer reporting, which is to say a film critic doesn't just say whether they think something is good or bad. The job of a film critic is to examine what a movie is saying. communicate that to the reader, and then if they feel convicted to make a recommendation, attempting to determine which readers would enjoy the film. Number two is learn the history of movies. This is pretty simple these days, thanks to the internet. You should scour Wikipedia, read essays at Criterion Collection, watch videos on YouTube channels like Filmmaker IQ and The Motion in Pictures. Those are two really good channels, and just find out about the history of movies from the ground up. Find out about how and why filmmakers started using lenses, camera movement, sound, blocking, performance, and music to symbolize meaning and narrative. Number three is read as much of the work of well-regarded film critics as possible. In addition to contemporary greats like Michael Phillips and Keith Phipps and Glenn Kenny, you should check out film critic legends like Andrew Saris, Pauline Kael, David Thompson, and of course Gene Siskel and Roger Ebert. You should also make time for counterintuitive and often maligned critics, somebody like Armand White. His reviews are really fascinating and very well written, despite being diametrically opposed to the popular online movie nerd trends. It seems like movies is one of the most popular things to talk about on the internet, but I think the true film discourse is threatened to take a decline. But thanks to shows like Aspect Radio and all the other great podcasts out there, and along with all the other resources on the web, I look forward to film fans becoming people that really love and know how to talk about movies. Thanks, guys. Follow me at Wondermill Films on Twitter. Also just joined Vine. I don't know why, but at Wondermill Films on Vine. And watch our new short film, Frankenstein's Master, at youtube.com/Wondermill Films. Thanks, guys. Bye.
Thanks, as always, to our producer, Andrew Richardson, and Corey, to you for driving down again. And until next week, from Tuscaloosa, Alabama, I'm Ben Flanagan.
And I'm Corey Kraft. This has been Aspect Radio, or Lee Daniels Aspect Radio. Thanks for listening.
Are we not based on the novel pushed by Sapphire?
Based on the novel pushed by Sapphire.